Hi everyone, this is Klaatu, and this is GNU World Order. Today I have back with me Lost in Bronx.
Well, thank you very much for having me on. It's a pleasure.
Well, you keep coming out with, I don't know, it seems actually worthwhile interviewing you. So, I think last time you were on here, we were talking about Blue Heaven, which was an audio play that you did, or audio book, I guess, that you did. This time we're talking about Motherload, which is both, it's going to be an audio drama, I think, correct, or an audio book, as well as a printed book, or an EPUB, and Mobi, which I have now read some of. So tell me about Motherload. How did it come about?
First off, Motherload, it's another science fiction, but it's very different from Blue Heaven. Blue Heaven was, I mean, at least as far as I'm concerned, it's more of a drama set in a science fiction, you know, universe or with a sci-fi setting. But Motherload is a straight-up space opera. It's an adventure, and it doesn't pretend to be much more than that. I came up with the story. I wrote the story a couple of years ago, and we had just moved to Arizona, and my wife was working, and I was home with the boy, and, you know, I didn't have a lot to do, so I started writing this story because I was it was kind of a dry spot for science fiction media, you know, at least for movies and TV and stuff like that. There was still, you know, a lot of really good books and stuff coming out, but I had in my mind I'd love to see some good space opera, and I hadn't seen any in quite a while, and that's what I love. I mean, I'm sorry, I know it's out of fashion, and I know a lot of people think that space opera is silly or juvenile, and that's fine. That's fine. I don't really mind that, but it's what I really enjoy. I love the idea of spaceships and ray guns and all that stuff. It's just who I am. So that's what this story is. It doesn't pretend to be any, you know, great statement about the human condition. I may get into that in other stories. In fact, I'm working on the second book now. It's called Street Candles, and it takes place on a colony world that's undergoing a political revolution. And it stars the same main character who just happens to find himself in a really bad place and has to try to survive it. But and I may get into more about what I think people and human societies are like, or maybe ought to be like, in that story. But this one is more of a straight-up adventure. It is a novella. It runs about 25,000 words, roughly. The audiobook will be a three-part story. The first one runs about 48 minutes. The second part is running 55, something like that. And the third one looks to be about maybe 50 minutes. I'm still working on the third one. It's given me no end of trouble, this third part, technically. But when it's all done, we're talking about, what, like an hour and 45 minutes to tell the whole story? That includes intros and outros. So it's not an extensive novel, nor is it a big time commitment to a reader or listener.
Well, I'm a huge fan of the space opera, which I've never really liked that term, but I mean, it means something to sci-fi people now. We all know what we're talking about when we say that. So for people who might not know what that term is, although I have a feeling most of my listeners will, we're talking sort of things like, I don't know, classic Star Trek or Firefly or Heinlein, like his early stuff, like Red Planet stuff, like adventures, just flat-out adventures in space.
Yeah, some of Star Trek falls very comfortably into the space opera element. Much of Star Trek, as you know, is also allegorical, and that's more of a literature standpoint, you might say, than a straight-up adventure standpoint. But yeah, Firefly, one of my biggest influences, early Heinlein, of course, one of my biggest modern influences is the author C.J. Cherry and her Merchanter series.
Oh, yeah, I've read some of those, actually.
Yeah, those are wonderful. Those are, I mean, I could move into that universe, I would. I mean, that's just absolutely wonderful to me. Of the modern authors that are doing things that I think are fantastic, certainly Nathan Lowell, I think, I mean, I you know, enraptured by his Solar Clipper series, and I just love his stories, and that's because it's set in a place that I'd love to be. Not because they're grand adventures. Some of them are quite adventurous, but most of it is just mundane stuff, and there is an attraction to the mundane quality of things. And I have extensive, even in this short novella, Motherload, I have extended, you know, aspects of just, you know, everyday living in that story, mostly about dealing with everyday problems, or at least problems if you're in a, you know, a machine setting like a spaceship that isn't working properly, which is the setting for Motherload.
I actually was noticing that as I was reading it, and I haven't gotten through the whole thing yet, but parts of it were almost about, like, you know, the act of troubleshooting, which even though they're troubleshooting an engine of a spaceship or whatever it would be, or the power system of the spaceship, which I've never done, but, you know, I can identify with that aspect of like, oh, I'm a technical person. Here's people barking orders over my shoulder saying, why isn't it working? Why isn't it working? And I'm trying to figure out why it's not working and how I can fix it. And it really appealed to me. And I wondered if, I think it would appeal to a lot of us sort of Linux geeks. And I wonder if you were aware of that while you were writing it, or whether that's just what you think about. I mean, was there a reason for writing about things like that?
Well, when I was writing it, I was just kind of geeking out on the technobabble and the internal logic of why this thing isn't working, right? And it's kind of an organic thing. When I start off with this premise, the power supply doesn't work right. Because of that, they have to fix it, right? Well, then I have to start looking at why doesn't it work, right? It doesn't work because of this thing. Well, if that's the problem, why don't they have a replacement? Well, there's this thing, and then there's this problem and that problem. And soon, in order to, you know, fix all these little plot holes and keep this thing floating, you know, so to speak, the premise that they can't fix this thing easily, you end up with this big, long technical explanation. So you either put that in, you do the old hand-wavy thing and say, well, it's just, it's busted, and you don't even go into any of that. Well, that can be fine, too, if you have a lot of action that you have to get into. But a good portion of the suspense of this thing is the setup, at least the way I'm looking at it. The fact that this thing doesn't work, right? So when the trouble does finally come, you know just how screwed they really are, because this thing really can't work. You know, and they really are in big trouble. That was the concept behind it. As I went on, I realized that, you know, kind of really geeky technical people are likely to, you know, have an appeal to this sort of thing, where you get into, you know, the technical explanations of this ship and why this does work or why it doesn't work. And again, it's going to be lost on maybe a lot of readers or listeners. They're going to find it a little, you know, boring. For some people, you know, even Star Trek fans, for some people, you know, when they do get into some technical explanations of this fictional problem that they might have, a lot of these people, you know, or viewers, a lot of people, they don't like that. That's not their favorite part of it. So it's not going to be for everyone by any means.
Well, I'm going to have to beg to differ a little bit, because my next question was about the cast of characters. And of course, anytime you have technobabble and stuff like that, as long as you've got a good set of people working behind all that stuff, I think most readers are going to find it pretty interesting. And so I'm wondering if in the second book you do plan to bring back the same little crew. What is it, a four-person crew, right? Sally, Bayern, Guinness, and the main character whose name I can't pronounce.
His name is pronounced Ejok. It's exact how it looks. The explanation for his odd name comes in the second book, but essentially it's an acronym for traffic control on spaceships, or rather space stations. His mother, as it turns out, was a space traffic controller or an orbital controller, and EJOC is an acronym that means ejection on cue, and it refers to the order in which a ship is allowed to it's allowed to leave the station. Very, very technical and kind of stupid and weird, but it's a setup for a future storyline, because he's kind of estranged from his family, and that isn't part of it necessarily, but it plays into it. And that's probably more information than you wanted, but that's the kind of
great
story
I love
this
it.
Is.
Right, yeah. So is it going to be the same cast of characters for the next book then? I mean, are we going to see Sally again? You know, I mean, there was some interplay there.
There was, but no. And when you get to the end of the story, you'll see that there is a definite conclusion to the whole thing. The story, the series, I mean, it's the first book in the series, and the series is called Star Drifter. And Star Drifter refers to Ejok. That's what he is. He drifts among the stars from job to job to job. You know,
Nice.
He's one of those guys, and I have this is kind of a blurb that I have on my website, but he's one of those guys that's really good at his job. He's got a lot of training, he's had his education, he's got a lot of experience, but he's really kind of bad at being around other people. You know, he can do his job really well if people let him do it, but part of jobs is working with other people, and that's the part he sucks at. And as a result, he kind of goes from job to job to job.
Gee, I wonder if any Linux users will identify with that aspect of the character.
He is essentially a loner and this is his story and his story arc. But in this future time, he will, more or less behind the scenes, without anybody in the greater universe really seeing what he is about, will have major indirect effects on the events and the history of the human race. But like a lot of people, he'll be an unsung, I don't even know if hero is the right word, but, you know, we hear about some of these great events, but we never hear about the people that, you know, were doing all the technical work behind the event itself, you know. We hear about rescues at sea, and we hear about great battles, you know, by vast armies and empires, and we never hear about the guys that, you know, helped build the roads or helped to, you know, keep the lights running or help keep the computers up and running, right? These people are never named. These people are never considered to be the influencers of the situation, of the event. And yet, without them, things would have been very, very, very different. And that's the kind of character that I wanted to portray here.
Yeah, it's really funny that you mentioned that as well, because, I mean, again, that was kind of my next point that I wanted to make before we moved on to just discussing the technical aspect of writing books on Linux. But, I mean, I love the fact that this story starts out and goes along with these people on, like, a space, a freighter or something. You know, it's very unglamorous. It's not about a captain in a big military. It's not that. It's, like, it's about the average Joe, and I really, really like that. And it's fairly unique. I mean, it's been done before. Obviously, there's other books out there about the average guy in a space opera kind of setting. But I found it really refreshing that that's what this was about. And I'm glad to hear that the rest of the series will also be about that. So how can people get it?
Well, they can, at this point, the Kindle version is available at Amazon. Do a search there for Motherlode. You'll get a couple of different books, including, you know, one that covers pregnancy. Don't bother with that one. That's not me. But that costs $1.99. That's what I'm asking for it. I still don't know if that's a good price or a bad price.
Sounds fair to me.
If, you know, I'm a cheapskate. Everything sounds too much to me. But if you'd rather not pay for it, that's fine, too. I have it under Creative Commons. First off, if you know somebody who's already bought it, just get a copy from them. You know, that's fine. If not, you can go to my website, which is cavalcadeaudio.com, and look under the shows category. You know, I have a little drop-down list, and look for Star Drifter, which is the series, and then you'll see Motherlode. And I have plain text versions that are available for free download there. The audio version I'm still working on. As I said, I'm on part three, and I really wanted to have all three parts finished before I put anything out, simply because I don't want to be doing that while I have other projects. I mean, I still have a Christmas episode for my sitcom, Eddie Kay, that I need to bang out, and that shouldn't be that hard. I know what I want to do with that, but I do want to have time to get that done and out before Christmas time. You know, so there are a lot of projects that I still want to get done, and on top of that, I'm still fighting with the RSS feeds and everything else on the website. I've done all that by hand, so it's been slow going, and I've tried to do about 15 things at once, and, you know, those balls that are in the air are starting to drop fast.
Yep, I hear you. Let's talk about how you did this technically, since you are saying that you did it all by hand. What's your process for writing? I mean, this is like, I don't know, on the EPUB version that I've got, it's like 72 pages of text. What do you use to write in, and how do you do it?
Okay, first off, I'm running Slacker Media, 13.37.
Oh,
yeah,
nice.
Still on Slacker Media. It wouldn't matter because, if you know, I'm a Linux guy, so any Linux version that I might run is going to have Nano, and Nano is my text editor. That's what I write in. That's what I do everything in. So although I'm running it on Slacker Media, in fact, if I was running this on Ubuntu or anything else, I would still be using Nano because that's what I prefer.
Does Nano have a GUI version at all, like, you know, gvim and Emacs, or you just do it in the terminal?
I do it in the terminal, but I do it. I do the terminal as an Xterm, so I have it on the GUI side rather than having to run into a virtual machine, because it's hard to cut and paste between virtual machine and the GUI, so I don't do that. So I'm running Nano in screen in an Xterm.
Now, do you write in plain text, or do you write in XML? Because EPUB obviously is just XML.
I do everything in plain text. And because, I mean, once you have plain text, you can do anything with it.
Okay.
And I think it's the best place to start, because if you can get it into a polished form in plain text, at least in my opinion, it'll go a lot smoother all the way down the line. But if you have any special formatting whatsoever, the moment you try to do anything else with that, you got to deal with formatting issues, you know? And I would rather, from the start, if I'm going to put it into XML, all I got to think about is the XML. I don't have to think about stripping anything out. You know what I'm saying? So I start off in plain text. I'm much, much more comfortable in that. I mean, there are a lot of people that, it's, you know, especially running on Linux, if they're writers, a lot of people work with OpenOffice and, you know, major text editors. Even something like AbbeyWord, which is, you know, pretty lightweight, even that's far more. It does far, far more than I need, you know. I don't even have OpenOffice or AbbeyWord on this machine. I mean, it doesn't. Those things don't come by default, and I've never really felt the need to use them. The few times that people send me, like, doc things, I just use a CLI application, you know, like AntiWord or something like that, to turn it into text so I can read it, because in the end, I don't really give a crap what it looks like as long as I can get the, you know, the content. You know, everything else is kind of a waste. It's a little slower. It is, but my machine's not clogged up with a massive program that I'm only going to use once a year, so, you know, it's worth it to me. So I start off with Nano, and I do, you know, I have a very specific formatting when it comes to, well, audio scripts anyway, but for writing, I mean, for books, it's relatively straightforward, but there's nothing there that I can't do for a straight, plain text version of story or a book or something like that. I don't need any special formatting for that, at least the way I do it.
This is going to sound like a fake question almost, because people probably don't really care, but I'm actually curious. Do you do each chapter as its own text file, or do you just write it in one big monolithic text file?
For Motherload, it was all one monolithic text file with, I think I used, you know, like a lot, you know, a dashed line, you know, between chapters or, you know, something like that, because I knew from the start it was going to be a novella and it's going to be short. For larger works, each chapter is a separate text file. It makes it a lot easier to find something when you got to go back and look for it, you know, especially in the first draft when, you know, I'm up to chapter 5 and I make a reference to something and it's like, what was that called thing? You know, what was that thing called again? You know, and I could, you know, since I don't know what it was called, I can't do a search for it, so I got to remember what chapter it's in, and at least I can narrow it that way. There is a disadvantage to that, too, though, especially if you're doing things like, you know, search and replace of particular phrases or words. You know, then you got to break it down, you know, from, you know, I could start getting into some more advanced bash stuff where I could, you know, do search and replace of all these different text files, but I, you know, that would take days just to learn how to do that, and I'm, you know.
No, it's super easy. It's one sed command. You'll be amazed. It's really simple.
Don't tell me it's super easy. You don't know how many times you've told me things are super easy. I don't know how many times. It is, you know, keep it to yourself. I don't want to hear it.
Okay, well, how do you get your plain text into the EPUBs and Mobi? I know nothing about Mobi, so what's your work process there? How does it end up in EPUB?
It was a mess. Plain out, it was a flat out mess, and I am of the opinion that GNU Linux and possibly every other operating system out there needs a one stop shop for producing ebooks. I'm not talking about writing text. That doesn't really matter. You can do that in almost anything. Every operating system has got the perfect tool for that. It really doesn't matter. But I don't know that anybody has made a really good tool to get from your text to a finished ebook. Now, the way I did it this time, and it won't be the same way next time, I'm sure, I took my plain text and I put it into the Lix text editor or document producer. Now, that thing is based on
the LaTeX thing? Is that what you're...
LaTeX. Yeah. It's in LaTeX, yeah. And That's a really cool tool. That's an amazing tool. It really is. But it was overkill for what I needed, right? Because in the end, and I didn't understand this, in the end, all I needed was to get my plain text into an HTML format to start off with. And that was overkill for that. It did allow me to do some really, you know, cool things, but I didn't really need them. If I was going to produce something in PostScript or something like that, it would be my tool of choice. But I probably will skip that stage next time. I found a CLI application that can turn a text file into an HTML file. In other words, it'll have your spacing, you know, basic spacing, and you know, if you edit it by hand, you can create a truly nice HTML document, you know, including bold text and, you know, proper font headings and stuff like that. I wouldn't necessarily want to do it by hand because I'm going to be prone to mistakes. So I'd like to automate that as much as possible. So once I exported, now again, this is the way I did it this time. Once I exported my file in my plain text file as an HTML document in Lix, I then opened that up in a WYSIWYG HTML editor so that I could edit individual lines, right? And the code, underlying code, would be perfect. It would, well, it would be better than if I did it by hand. Let's put it that way.
Yeah.
And the WYSIWYG editor that I used was SeaMonkey. That has a HTML editor.
Oh, okay. Part of that. Interesting.
Suite. Well, it also comes pre-installed in Slackware. So, you know, and I used to use SeaMonkey as my browser of choice, so I was already familiar with it. So that's a very simple thing to use. It's very basic as these things go. But then, you know, I don't want anything with too many options. If I have too many options, I'm going to get confused because this is all new to me. You know, maybe 20 years down the line when I'm an old pro, it won't be anywhere near enough. But right now, it's almost too much as it stands. I really did an awful lot of nipping and tucking. I would make a change and then turn it, you know, then save it and look at it and then turn it, you know, into an EPUB from the HTML. Now, the way I manage that is with Calibre. Okay, and Calibre, you can convert HTML documents, you know, you can convert things into EPUB, right? And from EPUB, you can then turn it into a Kindle using a Kindle CLI app that Amazon has available.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, I think there may be a GUI version of it, but the basic version of it can be done. Actually, Calibre can do it too. Calibre can do it. All of the last step, turning it into a MOBI, is kind of a waste. All right, and the reason being is that Amazon, when you upload, will automatically convert to .MOBI format anyway. Okay. So taking that step out of my workflow is probably the best choice, because if I screw it up there, it's going to be screwed up later. But if Amazon does it, it's going to be exactly the way they need it, right? So I'm probably going to, from this point on, not export a .mobi file to upload, but instead an EPUB, which they then convert to .mobi. I guess that's pretty trivial. There's only a little bit of code difference. It's vital, apparently, but it's not much. So going with an EPUB, in other words, the final EPUB will look an awful lot like the final .mobi. As you can see, now that was, how many programs did I mention? Four, five? I think I even missed a couple here and there. You know, not to mention, you know, individual, you know, command line things for doing word counts and spell checking and everything else. I mean, I don't know how much software I had to throw at this thing to get it into this format. And I've had some good feedback about the way it looks now, but I got to tell you that I know the best-selling authors aren't doing this.
Right.
I know they're not jumping through these hoops. So there's got to be a better way to do it, and I haven't found it yet.
Well, I will say that my EPUB workflow has gotten down to literally two programs. It's Emacs, which I write now directly to XML, which I never thought I'd be able to do. I thought that was, you know, I didn't want to be trying to write creatively and manage docbook tags, but it's so ingrained in me now that it's literally like I'm writing plain text. So I do that, and then I use a little program called XML2, XMLTO, and the newest version of that, so not the one that you'd see on Slackware 13.3.7, but the new one that I got when I installed it on Slackware 14, actually does go straight out to EPUB. It just does it for you. So it's literally two programs now that I need for that.
Wow, that is really smooth. But if you did not know the XML.
Something new from KDE, or Caligra, I guess, which is part of KDE. They are planning to do, or I guess they are in development now, of a, you know, a GUI app for people who do not know the DocBook and XML stuff. It's a program called Author, and it's supposed to be the one-stop shop for creating EPUBs in KDE.
Okay, well, that's cool. That's very cool. That's it's in development, which means it's probably something that could work
right now. And it could also mean that it doesn't work at all yet. I haven't looked yet. So.
Well, considering the growing popularity of EPUB and the Kindle marketplace, that is almost certainly going to be perfected in a short amount of time, because there's a huge demand for this, and Linux users write books just like everybody else, and there's a great need for it. And there's the problem is, as an author, I shouldn't be killing myself thinking about the formatting of this stupid book, right? That is not right. You know, especially when there's software that can do it for me, right? If I have to do the thinking first, if I have to do all the planning, and that's a separate job. That's an entirely separate kind of job. And, you know, it's not one that I really signed up for, quite frankly. I didn't want to be a typesetter. That's never been my goal in life.
Right.
By the same token, when it's polished and it looks nice, I can take a lot of pride in that. But, you know, I can take a lot of pride in, you know, making a nice omelet. I don't really necessarily have to beat myself up for weeks to get that level of pride.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's great that you know, it can be done patchwork like you did, or now fairly quickly like I do, but then I need to know all this weird stuff that you know, I could quite possibly not know, like DocBook. I just happen to know that because I had a job that taught me it. But, I mean, that kind of blockade to someone's creativity is a very dangerous thing. And quite frankly, for the first 2 years of my usage of Linux, that was kind of me and music. I was still trying to figure out how all these different programs come together in order to do anything musical. So I literally had to put a lot of my creativity kind of on hold to learn it all. And so I think if we can get rid of that blockade, I think it's a lot better for new users. And I also think that it's amazing that that you're driven enough to take all those different programs and patch them all together. Whenever I have to do it that way, I'm always thinking, I'm doing this wrong. And I almost don't want to do it just because I know there's a better way to do it. But you just went with it, and yeah, it looks great. I mean, it opens up, it reads, it's an EPUB, it works. Who cares how you got there?
That's good. You know, it's good that it turned out okay for everybody, but you get to a point where you're so invested in a thing that you don't have, you can't turn back, you know, because if you do, everything you've done up to that point has been for nothing. So when you're ignorant, as I am, you need to accept that, right? I don't know about anybody else. Some people see it as a challenge and they have to overcome it, but I'm a slow learner. I'm the first one to admit it. I'm a slow, slow learner, and that's just how I am, all right? Once I own a thing, it's mine, and it's mine for good, but it can take me a long time to get there. And the question is, did I want to get this book out this year or next year? That's really what it comes down to, right? If I put it out next year, I might have a much better handle on the process, right? Because I will have practiced, I will have, you know, put together all sorts of test runs and this and that and gotten it to look perfect using just a couple of methods that I could consistently do over and over and over. That's nice in theory, but in reality, chances are I was going to be discouraged after a month and I wouldn't have gotten anything done. So the point for me is to make some sort of progress. Is it the right way to go? Is my method a good one to try to repeat over and over? Absolutely not. Right? Everything I just described is the last way anybody should try to put one of these things together, including me, and next time I'm not going to do it if I can help it. But it got done, and that is more important than the method. And you have to bolt your way past your ignorance sometimes. You have to look at it and say, you know, it isn't perfect, but it's good enough. All right, for now, it's good enough. And if I can fix it later, it's especially good enough. You know, because now I'm not married to it. If I can fix it later, I will fix it later. If I can't, well, if it's pretty good, it's going to have to be pretty good. Otherwise, I'm never, ever going to be done with this project. You know, I'm at that stage now. I wanted to put out my first episode of Motherlode, the audio version, when I had all three done. But the third one is really holding me up. And honest to God, if I continue to wait, I may not have this thing done this year, you know, because I'm doing all these other things at the same time. So I may just put out the first episode next week and continue working on this other thing, you know, the third part, because it's giving me trouble. I didn't want to do it that way. That's not the way anybody who does audiobooks recommends that it get done. But my situation isn't theirs, and my workflow isn't theirs, and my schedule isn't theirs. So I have to make that call for myself. And anybody who is looking for a project, anybody who is taking on a project, especially one that is fairly well-trodden by people who are going to stand there and tell you that they're experts or talk like they are, okay? Anybody who is trying that, you have to find your own way. Okay, your way isn't necessarily going to be their way. Now, you got to listen to them. You really do, because they have it before. You have to hear what they have to say. But when they say, this is the way it's got to be done, don't take that for granted. Listen to why they say it has to be done that way. And if their reason is something as shallow as, well, that's because everyone expects it to be this way, that's not good enough. All right? That is nowhere near good enough for you. For you, getting the job done, that's the only thing that matters. And if it isn't exactly precisely like the way everybody else does it, you know, that really isn't such a bad thing. In fact, it's a pretty damn good thing.
I wholeheartedly agree with you. I think that that's one of the things that appeals to me about the Linux community anyway, because one of their things seems to be, like, let's just get this thing up and running. Yes, it might not be completely future-proof. It might not be elegant. It might be, quote-unquote, hacked together. But it's gonna make our wireless work, or it's gonna make this work, you know, whatever. And it gets done. And I think that realizing that kind of urgency and sort of just let's just do this kind of attitude artistically is really, really powerful. And I've just known too many artists in my day who, you know, they just let all these excuses get in their way. And I think it's great when people don't make up excuses. They don't let that stuff get in their way, and they just get something done, like your book.
I agree with you. I especially agree with you because for much of my life, I was that guy. You know, I was the guy that had a million excuses. I was the guy that always had a book in mind and never on paper or, you know, on computer screen. It's really easy to find reasons not to do a thing. You know, it's easier to not do something than to actually do it. I mean, we all know that. I got to tell you, you mentioned the Linux community and the similarities there. I can tell you, I believe, very much for a fact that had I not started running Linux, now I've been running it about 5 years full time, and had I not gotten involved in the community behind it and the do-it-yourself ethos that permeates this community, I'm not sure I'd have written this book at all myself, or at least gotten it to this stage. And the reason is that on a daily basis, I see that people are doing things. These are regular people who have regular lives, but they also have something that they love, or something that they're hacking together, or something that someone needs help with, and an hour later they have a solution, or an attempt at a solution. An attempt, that's fine. You know, that's something. And there are as many bad stories as there are good stories about that, too. I mean, we all have heard about, you know, the failures, but that isn't really what it's about. In fact, getting the book finished and getting it into market isn't really what it's about. At least, I don't believe it should be. The idea is that you're progressing day by day by day. You're progressing in the thing you love. You don't have to ever get to the goal if the journey is a good one. You know, if you're enjoying yourself as you go, if you're making progress, if you're finding a solution bit by bit, just bit by bit, finding a solution to your problem, creating your art, creating your program, solving your problem. If bit by bit you can get there, that's great. That gives you meaning. That gives you a reason to get up. And so many of us are getting up because we have to, because the alarm clock says we have to, or because someone else is expecting us to do a job for them, or all these other expectations. How many of us get up because we have something of our own creation, our own internal process that needs to be fulfilled? And I mean, I'm in a better position now creatively than I have been in my entire life. And that's only because I have adopted an ethos of just going ahead and doing it.
Our story begins here, with coffee. Its flavor caught in the closed fist of the bean, freed then by the grinding mills in an endless cascade, brewed into a beverage that is consumed in the hundreds of millions of cupfuls each day.
Lost in Bronx, you're kind of, I don't know, I keep wanting to say the word famous, but it sounds kind of cheesy. But, I mean, you're kind of, among this community, you're quite well known for your audio productions, like Eddie Kay especially. So, although my personal favorite, Blue Heaven. But what are these audio productions going to be like? And tell me a little bit about your process.
This production, I'm calling it an audiobook version of Motherlode, but it's kind of a hybrid. Again, it goes back to that, you know, everyone tells you there's a certain way to do things. If you look into the audiobook format for fiction, you'll get a lot of advice from people. And many of these are very successful people who know what they're talking about. But as I said, they're not me, and they don't have my experience, and they don't have my vision for this particular story. And so it's a hybrid. The audio version is kind of a hybrid between a standard audiobook, where someone is basically just reading the story, and an audio drama that has distinctive voices and sound effects and music. The difference between this and an audiobook is that characterizations are very much like a standard audio drama. I have distinctive voices for every character, and I don't have any he said, she said, they said, that sort of thing. That's usually dropped from most audiobooks anyway. But this is taking it to, I think, a step beyond that, where it is much more like an audio play than anything else. However, how does this differ from an audio drama, a standard audio drama? Well, first off, I don't have any sound effects, all right? I didn't put any in. So it's much more like a book in that regard. I do have music and musical interludes that I find those can help simply from a pacing standpoint and for creating mood. And also, I do a little bit of audio effects on voices, because at some point people are talking through microphones and things like that, so I change that a little bit so that it sounds kind of like they're talking through a microphone. Also, there's extensive narration, because it's a story that's primarily told from a first-person singular. He's you know, it's all a remembrance. Ijak is telling you in the past tense everything that happened. So he's the narrator. He's also the primary character. So I have two distinct voices in the story. I have Ijak, the narrator, and I have Ijak, the main character. Those have to be done differently, and they have to sound differently so that you can be sure who's speaking when those voices come up. There are other differences, too. Most e-books are they're not done with multiple channels where you move one character off to one side and another character off to another, because you're not creating that illusion of space. Generally, they're not. So this, I'm not doing that either in this particular one. So everything is coming from you, audio-wise, it's coming from you from the center. That's actually hard. That makes it a lot harder, because one of the beauties of using that technique is that you can make distinct, you instantly know who's speaking based on where they are in the room. And in this particular case, I'm not doing that. Frankly, I don't know if this works all that well. This is, again, it's a hybrid, it's new, I've never heard anything quite done this way, and the differences are subtle, but pretty important. So that doesn't answer your question from the technical standpoint of how I did this, but that is where I'm starting from. That is the basis of where I'm starting from for the construction of the audio version.
Now, are they going to be, I know you have more to say, but are they going to be released at the same time, ideally? I mean, I know you still got the third one going on, but is the plan to just dump them all online and let people download all three parts, or do you have a staggered release in mind?
I'm thinking one a week. That'll give me time to get a little bit of feedback in case people find problems on the first one.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
You know, someone might say, well, gee, your OGG file is messed up, or this isn't working, or that isn't working, or something, or the download feed is screwed up, or, it's just a little bit of feedback. Plus, it'll give me time to finish the third one, so at least I'm hoping it will.
So what is your, I mean, you're probably, what, an Audacity user, or do you, Ardour or Audacity?
Both, actually. Well, first off, I recorded this, all the voices in this, in using a Zoom H4n.
Very nice.
Which I no longer have.
Oh.
That thing, they died on me, actually. That was a complete surprise. But here's what happened. I had filled the card up, right, because that had an 8-gig card in there, and I filled it up, and I didn't want to get rid of it because that's my ultimate backup of all the primary voices, right? So I didn't want to erase any of that. I had to keep it. Well, I didn't have another card. It uses a standard SD card, or SDHD, I guess, I don't know. But I did have a micro SD card in an adapter. So I put that in there, and I couldn't get it out. It wouldn't pop out again. It was jammed. I futzed with that thing for an hour, and it would not come out. It was jammed. I used a surgical hemostat to try to get it out, but then the SD card slot was jacked up. It wouldn't hold the cards anymore. Well, the H4N doesn't have any onboard storage of any kind. Everything goes to a card. If the SD card slot is jacked up, the thing is useless. Okay? It doesn't work at all. So I took it apart just to try to get to, you know, see if there was anything I could do for it. And that was a process on its own, but I took it all apart until it was all in pieces. And then when I looked at the card slot, it was really bent and jacked up. And it's wired directly to the motherboard. And that's about the extent of my hardware capability. I am not going to, you know, try to find the right kind of SD slot that will fit this device and cut, you know, then take this thing out and solder a new one in and hope the whole thing works. I had to get something else. So now I have a Tascam DR40, which is pretty much in the same category. These are kind of lower-end recorders, but they have XLR jacks, right? And I use an XLR microphone. I have a small studio, so to speak, set up out in a shed we have in the yard, and I have my mic hanging there. And from there, I transfer the audio, which is in WAV format, to Audacity. I bring it into Audacity, and I cut each individual voice. If I'm doing a particular character, I cut each individual voice and put it on its own track. I have, actually, up until recently, I have always worked in stereo. Each voice I worked with was in stereo, but I've started working in mono. I'm not sure. You know, everyone says, do mono, do mono, do mono. And I'm up in the air about that. That works for everybody, but I don't know if it works for me. But we'll see. It certainly makes the file sizes a lot easier to move around.
Well, I think the only reason you'd record in stereo was if you were trying to create that spatial illusion. Because, I mean, if you're not, then you might as well do mono, because people only have one mouth, so really you only need one microphone of their voice, you know?
You're right, and I bow to your expertise on multimedia stuff anyway, but I'm still exploring that, and I have to convince myself before I can, you know, be wholeheartedly committed to things.
Right.
But at any rate, in Audacity, I cut each individual voice and get the timing right for the conversations between the different characters. And it's important to know, again, I'm doing all the voices and trying to be distinct with each characterization, and that makes it easier for the listener to determine who is saying what and when. I'm not always perfect at it, and sometimes it's a little confusing. You know, you get what you pay for, I guess. But at any rate, that is a very long process. That is a very, very long process, because you're cutting individual lines. I'm doing 3 to 4 versions of each line, and that's assuming I got them right. If I screw up, then I got to keep going until I get at least 3 or 4 different takes for each line, and go ahead and pick the best one. And usually I cut and paste individual pieces of lines to get the best version of every word in every line, right? Because I'm anal that way. And it takes a long time. I mean, Eddie K5, which came out in, I think, July, that took me 6 months to make.
Wow.
6 months of mostly doing this. And now, granted, it was a 2-hour episode, but still, that's a lot of time to commit to a particular project. So you really got to be into it in order to, you know, to give yourself that kind of time thing. You don't have to go to this length either, but I'm anal that way, and I make a lot of mistakes, frankly. I make a lot of mistakes that need fixing.
Yeah, but, you know, to be fair, Lost in Bronx, they do that for professional work, and that's one of the reasons your stuff sounds so good, because you are that meticulous. I mean, I'm not saying that everyone has to be that way. I know that I personally am not on certain things, and then I am on other things. But I mean, that's like standard practice, and I think that's admirable, and it comes through.
That's good, because that's the goal, of course. But as you know, the better at a job you get, the faster you you almost certainly get at it. You know, you're faster and better at the exact same time. And that's always my goal. It's hard when you're continually evolving your methodology to progress to a point where you can consider yourself an expert at something. Unfortunately, I don't consider myself an expert at anything. You know, it's turning out that I'm more or less a jack of all trades, and I'm trying to squirt out what I can do myself entirely, start to finish, by just being okay at pretty much all of it. You know, as I, you know, like any job, the more I work at it, hopefully the better at it I will get. I think I'm a pretty good writer. I think I'm a pretty good actor overall, but I am a noob when it comes to the production end of it. I'm just barely getting my feet wet in Ardour, and that's the next step in the process. After I've cut my lines and I've gotten the timing down, and the timing is very, from a conversational standpoint, timing is everything. And Eddie Kay, being comedy, the timing is absolutely vital. It's where I spend most of my time.
Yeah,
and I screw it up even then, you know, because if you're listening to the thing over and over and over, after a while you don't hear it anymore, not really. But timing is everything, and that's very time consuming. I'm constantly moving bits of WAV file back and forth, and I mean, it's very, very time consuming. But once that's done, I export each individual track from Audacity. I put it out at 48 kilohertz because that's what Audacity is looking for, and it can be very crashy sometimes, especially if it has to do major conversion, you know, audio rate changes or anything like that when it's importing. When I get my crashes in Ardour, it's almost always when I'm importing. So I try to make that as smooth as possible for Ardour, and each individual track becomes a track in the Ardour project. And from there, I can start working on doing audio effects or putting voice effects on characters, raising or lowering volume, bringing other effects in and out, that's where I put the music in. And if I'm using sound effects, that's where that goes in too. So I've probably done 60% of the job in Audacity, and the following 40% is in Ardour, but that's where the project really shines. So that's the part you have to really, really focus on.
Yeah, and in the real world, like, I mean, my brother actually did that prep work, you know, the audio cleaning. So you'd have someone, you'd have like your assistant editor, essentially, doing all that audio cleaning in Audacity or whatever they're going to be using, and then you would send it over to the actual mixer who's going to be doing the production side of things. So as usual, you're wearing, like, you know, 8 different hats when you're an independent artist, but it's cool to hear this process, I think.
Yeah, and it is a distinctive difference, even though they're both audio editors, so to speak, and they can, in most jobs, if you're really, really expert at Audacity, you can do pretty much all of this in Audacity. The reason I cut voice in Audacity is that it's really fast, especially I use your keyboard shortcuts that you put together for Audacity, and that just launched. I mean, I save so much time doing that now, and that has made such a big difference. And there's probably a way to do it fast in Ardour, but I don't know it. And I, you know, at some point maybe I will. But it cuts really, really fast overall. The actual cutting and stuff, the adjusting for sound and everything, that takes, or for timing and everything, that takes forever. But the actual cutting and pasting and moving the tracks around, that's very fast in Audacity, and not as easy in Ardour. But I don't think Ardour was ever designed to do that sort of basic grunt work. I think it was meant, first off, I don't think it was ever meant to do the kind of cutting that I do. I think it was meant for music, and it's meant to follow a more traditional recording studio method. That is, you know, if you're punching in particular pieces of audio, you're going to be either injecting it or overwriting it, as opposed to, you know, cutting a piece here, having it on different tracks, and then matching everything up. And I don't know, maybe it is. I don't know.
But no, I think you're absolutely right. I think in other programs, in other big digital audio workstations that I've seen, they will either not have what Audacity has, and I do mean Audacity, like they just won't, you can't do that. And on the other DAWs that I got trained on in school, that was actually why we everyone had Audacity on their computer, because of things just like that. Like, they couldn't get in there and work with the waveform stuff efficiently in the big monolithic, you know, this is my mixing program, so they'd have to bounce it out to Audacity, do their little edits like you're doing, and then bring it back into their DAW. So I think you're doing it like right. I think you're correct about how, sort of the difference between those two apps.
Well, good. Good. Nice to know that I'm not making it up entirely this time.
Yeah.
Again. But from there, then I will export it as generally either a FLAC file when the whole thing is done. Well, usually I'll export one and listen to it on my media player. And I still have my Sansa Fuse, and that's running Rockbox, and I listen to the kind of a release candidate, so to speak. In fact, I mark them as release candidates, and listen to it to see if I can hear any major problems at that stage. And then I go back and I make any final changes, and I might have another release candidate, or if I find problems, the process could go on. But from that point, then I'll finally export either a WAV file or a FLAC file, depending on what it is that I need. And from there, I use Ogank, the command line tool to convert to Og, and I use Lame directly on the command line to convert to MP3.
Cool.
And then it's done.
That's great. That sounds like you have that a lot more efficient than your EPUB workflow.
Oh yeah, but I've had a lot more experience with it. I went into audio drama having done a fair amount of podcasting.
Yeah.
I had done, you know, some HPR stuff, Hacker Public Radio, and I have my own podcast called Palaver that I haven't updated in a year, but it's not dead. It isn't fading. It's just, you know, I'm busy. And a few things here and there. UI and Deep Geek, you know, had a short-lived audio show as well, or audio cast as well. So I've done some audio work in the past as well before I started the audio drama thing, and that was invaluable. That was absolutely invaluable, that information. It isn't a direct, like if you know podcasting, you can definitely do audio drama. It isn't directly like if you have a podcasting background, then you can definitely pick it up. And that really came in handy. And it's all been free software tools that got me to where I am today. And that's all I use. And I got to tell you, if I made $1 million on Motherload, it would still be all I use because it works. It's the best stuff. I mean, can I just say, I want to go on a rant about free software for a sec and not
Please
a bad
do.
One. Not a bad one.
Go for
okay.
it.
In my opinion, you know, I could not have created a single thing, not a single thing that I have out today, right now, without having used tools that people have given away for free. I write in free software. I cut my audio in free software. I upload in free software. My server that holds my website is free software. Okay? All of this stuff is based on things that other people have created and gave away. All right? And that's why all of my stuff you can get for free in some format or other. All right, because I couldn't have gotten where I am without that stuff, and I won't be able to make the next thing without that stuff. And maybe, hopefully, somebody somewhere down the line can get some value out of my stuff in the same way. Okay, now that is the value of the free culture and sharing. But free software in and of itself, okay, has a value because it taught me. I can't code. I'm not a programmer. But the use of free software has shown me the value in a community based around something that everyone is sharing in. That may sound, I don't know, touchy-feely or vague or whatever, but the fact is I felt a part of a Linux community. I'm not a coder. I'm not a hacker, okay? But yet I'm part of a community. I was brought in. I was allowed to come into this community. And it's because everyone is welcome here, okay? It doesn't really matter what your technical level is. You might get some ribbing about not knowing what you're doing, but you could get that no matter what. I found the Linux community to be very inviting, and whenever I have a technical problem, there are places I can go to get an answer, and answers that matter, answers that actually help me get the job done.
That's it for this week's episode. Thank you very much for listening. My name is Klaatu. You can reach me via email at klaatu@member.fsf.org. You can find me online at GNUWorldOrder.info or slackermedia.info. You can contact me via Jabber at notclatoo@jabber.org. You can also usually catch me in IRC as notclatoo. I'm on the Freenode Network in the channels Oddcast Planet, Dev Random, Slacker Media, Slackware. Any of those will do. Thank you very much for listening, and I'll talk to you next time.
Yes, coffee. We wouldn't be the great nation we are today if it weren't for coffee.